Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 21st of June, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're also joined by Alex Thompson. And Alex, of course, bringing us eastern approaches from the lowlands of the Netherlands. Well, it's a big day.
Halfway through the year.
Well, there's a bit of a debate about that because here we are, summer solstice, sun at its highest point, I think I'm correct in saying. Some people would say midsummer, some say not. But what we wanted to bring to you all today is that the UK government has put out a warning. These are the main points. Run, hide, tell, stay indoors, factor 100 sunscreen, protect your children, drink plenty of water, and keep a handy supply of those baby wipes.
Oh, they can't do that. They can't do that. They've just banned baby wipes.
Well, I'm sorry. They obviously thought that the possibility of extreme solar radiation, sunburn, was the most important thing.
Okay. Well, look, let's get on to more serious subjects. This is the report from about the Gosport War Memorial Hospital. A damning report, according to many mainstream media. It shows that 450 people had shortened lives as a result of being given opiates, powerful painkillers at this hospital. An additional 200 patients were probably killed similarly between 1989 and 2000. This morning on the Today programme, Brian Jarman was speaking, and he was saying that it was extremely likely that what had taken place that led up to these potentially 650 deaths is probably happening in a lot of other places as well. Now, Sir Brian Jarman is head of the Dr. Foster Unit at Imperial College London, and he told the Today programme that we should not be surprised to hear that there's a possibility that this is being repeated elsewhere. He said that whistleblowers are still being blacklisted for attempting to correct the problems. And he said that there really is a desire not to know by the NHS of the patient deaths. He said that whistleblowers are being fired, gagged and blacklisted. He was asked if he would be surprised if similar events were happening elsewhere, and he said not at all. He thought it was extremely likely. He did say something quite interesting towards the end of this interview, and I just wanted to play the last minute or so of it. So let's listen to Sir Brian Jarman.
Chess is a wonderful idea, but it's extremely centralised, and the things that I've read out to you, a thing that worries me, and perhaps I shouldn't really say it, but there is an organisation that seems to be... I didn't discover about it until a couple of years ago, but there is an organisation, it seems, that seems to be advising the NHS. I mean, the NHS is advised a lot by management consultants. They spend about, I think, £620 million on it. And you'll find that people on the boards of, say, the regular, say, the, if you talk, take the Care Quality Commission or even NHS England, will have been on management consultant groups before. But there seems to be a sort of super management consultant group, which I've only just discovered, right, called Common Purpose.
Well, Sir Brian, thank you so much for talking to us today. And obviously, it's a subject that we are going to come back to repeatedly. Sir Brian Jarman.
Now, I got the distinct impression that he was rapidly cut off at that point by Justin Webb. Didn't want to particularly go any further with that particular discussion. But following that and some Twitter discussion with Sir Brian Jarman about what he said on the Today programme this morning, he highlighted this presentation here from the Department of Health about the Common Purpose Working Group. And that was something that I had put a Freedom of Information request in about in 2013. Here is the answer from the Department of Health. And this is one of the key things he said to explain. Three meetings to discuss Common Purpose have taken place on the 9th of October 2012, 10th of December 2012 and 28th of January 2013, comprising a small set of strategy directors from the Department of Health and its arm's length bodies. The purpose of the meetings was to help foster constructive relationships across the new health and care system and to discuss issues of common interest. However, please be aware that, and this is my emphasis on the graphic here, please be aware that there is no membership of these meetings. Attendance has been varied. No minutes have been agreed between the participants and no terms of reference describing the purpose of the meetings. But in fact, if you look at the presentation, which Brian Jarman was tweeting out today and which they included in their answer to me, we see this cross-system common purpose working group agenda. And if we highlight that section there, discussion on purpose of the working group introduced by draft terms of reference and membership. So they're clearly discussing the membership of the common purpose working group, but following a freedom of information request, they're denying that there was any membership. So I'm not really clear exactly what the situation is here.
Well, the minimum, Mike, is that we've got common purpose meetings going on inside the NHS for which there are no minutes. That's common practice, for which there's secrecy around what's happening. That's common practice, for which the identity of the people is not revealed. That's common practice. And we know by Common Purpose's own documentation that the drive is for change agents within the NHS. What is the agenda to disrupt the NHS, cause breakdown? Because, of course, this is going to be used to advance the privatisation process. But the most sinister thing, and I think Sir Brian Jarman being very, very cautious in what he was saying, is that at the time of the mid-Staffordshire deaths, it was widely known in the NHS as the result of Sir Brian Jarman's excellent monitoring system of deaths that an equivalent rate of deaths to mid-staffs was happening in at least 10 or 11 other hospitals, a minimum of 10 or 11 other hospitals. We're dealing in tens of thousands of preventable deaths, many of them for elderly people. And what did the British government do when it was alerted to these deaths? And the first mid-Staffordshire report was put out alerting people to these high death rates. The British government brought in a common purpose working group, which effectively whitewashed all of the warnings. And for Sir Brian Jarman now to be prepared to point a finger at common purpose in a publicly broadcast interview tells me that he's now very confident at what he's looking at. But of course, it's been the UK column that has warned and brought most of the information to the surface. Now, perhaps Alex would like to come in. Sorry, before we go there, I'd just like to say a very big thank you to viewers and listeners, because many of you emailed us today to warn us about this interview. So this was one: dear Mr. Gerrish, you may be interested to know that this morning at about 7:45 on BBC's Today programme, Mr. Brian Jarman was discussing with the presenter the problems at Gosport Memorial Hospital, which were currently in the news. At the end of the interview, Mr. Jarman said, of course, there's a supranational organisation called Common Purpose, at which point the interview was abruptly terminated. So we received several emails like this, and I'm going to say thank you very much to our viewers. One, for alerting us, we do miss things, and also, of course, it tells us that you're absolutely picking up on what we're talking about. So, Alex, I don't know whether you'd like to comment on this. All of us at some stage are going to use the NHS, relatives use the NHS. The stories that we're hearing, and many of the stories are coming out as the result of whistleblowers in the NHS who are deeply concerned at what they're seeing. This is clearly orchestrated policy, do you think?
It certainly looks that way, Brian, when you look from a bit of a semi-distance from the Netherlands. My wife is a Dutch medic, and she's over with me visiting my parents here at the moment in Britain. And so last night there was, of course, a news segment on television about the Gosport Hospital cover-up, as even the BBC is admitting that it is now. And we were trying to explain this to my dear wife, because, of course, Dutch hospitals try not to kill their patients. And the conversation turned to my parents asking my wife, do you think that Britain is at some point is going to legislate for euthanasia? And the consensus we came to was that at the same time around the turn of the millennium, when the Dutch and Belgians and some US and Australian states said, well, we're going to inject old people when they're cumbersome, the British, in their usual fudge of a solution, decided that they were going to turn a blind eye to doing just that within the system without having a euthanasia policy. It's much the same way as Britain approaches many other policies. No debate, just a small coterie deciding what's good for the plebs.
OK, well, it's worrying stuff. There's a lot needs to be exposed. But while we had this exposure of common purpose in the NHS today, we were also alerted to this excellent article on the Conservative Woman. It was written by journalist Robert James. He often writes for the Daily Mail and a number of other newspapers. But here's the headline: Police cower from criminals. Burglaries are ignored. The Tories will pay for this betrayal. Encourage people to read this. And if we go into this article, I've just taken a couple of excerpts here, but he says they may well also be encouraged by statements such as that from Sarah Thornton, head of the National Police Chief Council, who said there are a lot less burglaries than there used to be, a lot less car crime. But the sorts of crimes that are on the increase, sexual offences, concerns about terrorism, cybercrime, that's where we really need to focus. Now, he was actually being sarcastic in saying that people are being encouraged by this, because previously in the article, a lot of information about the increasing crime rates had been shown. But the point is, first of all, that Sarah Thornton here is a common purpose trained senior police officer, and she's the police officer who was formerly Thames Valley, who refused to investigate the abuse of children at Oxford and Cherwell Valley College. But he goes on and he says here, adding Theresa May and Mr Khan's disastrous knife crime policy as previously discussed in The Conservative Woman, and you have a picture of policing the way the leftish official classes want it. Cressida Dick, the head of the Metropolitan Police, has reportedly been trained by Common Purpose, a group dubbed the left-wing Freemasons, whose courses have been attended by thousands in the public sector. Critics of the group say they are operating a highly political agenda, which is to install new chosen leaders in society. So quite remarkable that we've now got Today programme, or at least somebody who's able to get the information out about Common Purpose on Today programme in relation to the NHS. And here we've got another mainstream journalist warning of Common Purpose's impact on the police. And if we follow this through, really, on some of the comment we had from yesterday about Syria, I did mention this at the time, but just to get the graphics up, this is Common Purpose boasting about its programme for Syrian leaders in the diaspora, that aims to build their capacity to contribute to Syria and to the diaspora community. These are some of the goals that they say they're going for: enhancing the ability to lead beyond authority. That's a very key statement. You're not going to stay within your authority. You're going to simply ignore your boundaries. Develop their thinking on possible futures for Syria, never mind what the government of Syria thinks. Build new networks. Develop cultural intelligence, stretch analytical and creative skills, re-energise by connecting with inspiring peers and leaders from a range of different fields. So I took one further step to have a look at this, and we come up with this page where there's little embedded videos. And I was just fascinated to see that top left, we had a lady, Rania Alakra, who's an economist with the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And my question is, how does the UK's environment, food supply, rural community situation benefit from training Miss Alakra to be a Syrian leader? I really didn't understand this at all. Was she doing this course in public time, in which case the British government is paying, but her job is with DEFRA? It's not organising an external government for Syria. So I think there's a lot of questions to be asked here. And I'm also going to add, I believe this young lady is being cynically used. Before we comment, throw it open for comment, we just bring this one in, because at the same time, Common Purpose boasting that it had been meeting with the chief executive of Unilever, Paul Polman. It was boasting that it set up a Commonwealth 100 programme to train Commonwealth leaders, particularly in diaspora groups. And here's the big Unilever man. Now, let's get it right. Really, he runs a soap powder company. But here he is waxing lyrical on how his company is going to help save the world and change how we work together. And this is the sort of thing that Common Purpose is pushing. So they're talking about 88% of people. Sorry, just bring this up on screen. Where are we? 88% of young people are excited about the rise of artificial intelligence. 79% identify with two or more cultures. So here's the breaking down of national identity. And 78% of young people have personally experienced intolerance. Who was helping set all this up? The Bank of Zambia. And here's the gentleman himself. And if you research him, he's a very popular contributor to the Bank of International Settlements. This is pretty outrageous stuff. Alex, this pernicious organisation, which is funded by the banks and always was, is clearly now driving policy everywhere at local government level, but also, as we're now seeing, through the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and into the Commonwealth Office. Into the Commonwealth. Who are these people?
Well, I suppose one way to answer it would be go back to Lord Milner in the Edwardian era, the first decade of last century, who talked about the need for the aristocrats to shed their burden. And they were fake aristocrats anyway. They were arrivistes, as I mentioned in my AV9 talk. They were men who had been merchants and bought out the old aristocracy who had the idea of noblesse oblige. The new merchants live at a distance from the people, regard them as plebs to be controlled and rather disgusting characters. There's no real sense of burden towards them. So Lord Milner, who engineers the First World War, some good reading matter on that's available. Lord Milner's Second War is a very good book on that. Say in 1903-ish, we're going to have to get a new cadre of technocrats under us to do our bidding so that we can spend our time really playing at being lords. So that's why they set up groups such as Bilderberg to be given the agenda every year, and G7 also. Interesting that you mention Unilever boss there, because, of course, Lord Leverhulme from the soap producing area of the Wirral, just across the River Mersey from Liverpool, between the wars, he was one of these characters who made it filthy rich, and he bought the Isle of Lewis, Scotland's largest island, and tried to turn the Gaelic speaking crofters into industrialised herring fishers and tinners, a disastrous policy. You can read a book called The Soap Man all about it. So there's been a long tradition of captains of industry with ideas above their station, really trying to play fake nobility, and it works out worse than the real nobility. And of course, it spreads to countries where they have supposedly abolished the aristocracy as well.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Now let's move on to Brexit, because good news, Brian. The Great Repeal Bill, the so-called Great Repeal Bill, was passed yesterday. The allegations that there was going to be some kind of backlash against it didn't quite happen. This is a pretty big deal for the Prime Minister, apparently, according to various people. But before we talk about the big deal, let's just look at the really wonderful video that Theresa May put out this morning on this. Now, I'm just going to apologise to everybody that's going to be watching and listening for doing this to you, but I felt that under the circumstances, it's absolutely necessary. You'll maybe see why in a second.
Today, Parliament has passed the EU Withdrawal Bill, a crucial step in delivering a smooth and orderly Brexit, the Brexit people voted for. Today's votes show people in the UK and to the EU that the elected representatives in this country are getting on with the job and delivering on the will of the British people. Over the next few weeks, we will publish more details of our proposed future relationship with the EU in a white paper, and we'll bring the trade and customs bills back to the House of Commons. But today has been an important step in delivering the Brexit people voted for, a Brexit that gives Britain a brighter future, a Britain in control of its money, laws and borders.
So I do apologise for that, and particularly apologise for anybody that's only able to listen to it, because the point really was to see her in action. And, well, I'm pretty speechless, really. It was like a cat in the headlights.
Well, to me, Mike, actually, I'm going to say it was quite clear. This woman doing a dreadful job at trying to appear sincere, delivering this message. She's had a little bit of coaching, so she's trying to put on facial expressions to get the seriousness, the message across. It doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is she's not there. She's not delivering a message she believes in. She's just putting across a spun message. So appalling piece of acting by this prime minister. But she is only a puppet of the monetary powers which are driving the policy.
2 seconds, Alex, on this.
It's interesting that men like Richard D. Hall consult body language and speech experts. I've had little expertise in that from my GCHQ days. I try not to extend those bounds. But how interesting that to make every point, rather than nodding or moving laterally with the chin and the nose, it's a kind of flick of the head upwards, almost a kind of shake of the head, which possibly indicates some cognitive dissonance.
Yes. Well, there's certainly plenty of that around with regard to Brexit. Yeah. Right. Let's move on to Jens Stoltenberg, who's visiting Theresa May today, Secretary General of NATO, of course. Well, what's he talking about? He's really concerned about the breakdown, potential breakdown in the transatlantic relationship because of Donald Trump. He's really keen to try to keep that together. Gave a speech today at Lancaster House. This is a pre-summit address, and he explained the importance of the transatlantic bond, how it's being strengthened in NATO. He highlighted how defence ties between North America and Europe have grown closer. So, you know, 2 days ago he's writing articles for the Telegraph where he's really concerned about Donald Trump. He's concerned about the NATO summit in a few weeks' time turning into something similar to G7, and he's saying that the transatlantic bond is at risk. And now he's saying that really everything's fine, it's fantastic, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. He said, again and again, we unite around our common goal, we stand together, we protect each other. On screen, we've got another quote from it. I don't believe that NATO should counter propaganda with propaganda. NATO is not in the propaganda business. Well, I'm not clear because what he was saying a couple of days ago in the Telegraph isn't quite what he's saying today, so I'm not quite sure which one was propaganda, or maybe his opinion's just changed or something, I don't know. But anyway, NATO meeting in a couple of weeks' time. So in the meantime, Exercise Sabre Strike is going on, and this is quite amazing. 15,000 troops or so taking part in this, and British and French troops, of course, supported by many others. Deployed to Estonia and so on, the Russians getting a little bit upset about the constant stream of exercises that are taking place in Eastern Europe at the moment. And Sergei Shoigu, in fact, was making a comment on this today, saying the increase in NATO activities in the Baltics is forcing Russia to undertake symmetrical measures to negate the emerging threats. So, Alex and Brian, this seems to be Russia starting to sort of push back a little bit here. They've pretty much had enough of what's going on with all these NATO exercises. So, Alex, we'll start with you. I mean, what are your thoughts on the Russian response?
We'll have to bear in mind that Shoigu, a very deep expert with a great geostrategic understanding, mostly Middle East, actually, but Baltic is quite his bag as well. And when the Russians talk about symmetrical responses, they're not talking about measuring like for like. They're talking about getting new ideas to match the fact that they are being outfoxed or out-aggressed. So you can expect some fireworks from Russia within, of course, the norms of international law, which they're sticklers for. What's going on in Estonia includes things like landing AC-10 warthogs on dried up Estonian riverbeds and remote stretches of Estonian highway. And these are the tank busters that, you know, turn on one wing and destroy a whole tank regiment in one go with sustained fire. So that's the kind of firepower that NATO's bringing. There's talk of permanent presence of NATO in the Baltic, in Poland now, as well as, of course, the Polish buying kit if Congress approves it. Further thing I'd point out is that British-French exercise under NATO, it's rather interesting that it uses the US spelling of the word sabre, even though both English, or British English and French use the RE spelling of sabre. So it may have been directed from NATO headquarters or by American general.
That was a NATO video, so that possibly explains that. But look, one of the things that Shoigu said, one of the points he made, was that in the first half of 2018, NATO has conducted 13 large-scale military exercises involving only over 40,000 servicemen, 2,000 units of combat hardware near the borders with Russia. And of course, one of the things that's going to be discussed at this NATO summit in a couple of weeks, Alex, is this idea of a military Schengen within the EU area, the idea of being able to move troops rapidly, troops and hardware rapidly from one side of Europe to the other. So, you know, there is no sign of Russia, of NATO backing off the pressure against Russia at all. I'd be interested to know what you meant by fireworks in what you said a couple of seconds ago.
Well, I would say we don't know what the Russians have got up their sleeve, but it's going to be a response. And this is what I meant about symmetrical in Russian technical usage. Achieving like effect is what's meant when Russians, especially Shoigu, talk about that. So we have, our NATO foolish bosses, have decided to shock and dismay the Russians by landing tank busters in remote parts of the Baltics and holding all kinds of beach storming exercises and what have you. So the Russians are going to do something within the bounds of the current treaty law, which is going to shock and dismay the forward states of NATO and its so-called partners, Sweden and Finland, which complete the Baltic encirclement of Russia because they work alongside NATO as if they were members, despite their constitutional neutrality. So there'll be something perhaps relating to Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave, which used to be the northern half of eastern Prussia, which cuts off the Baltic republics from Poland. That, I think, is going to be the focus of some forward planting of some heavy equipment and possibly some aggressive exercises on Russia's part.
Okay. You any thoughts?
Well, all I'd say is that if you follow the NATO policy through, and of course the UK has been leading this, it has been to antagonise the Russians. There can be no doubt about this. Exercise after exercise pushed right up on the Russian borders. And as many people have commented in, you know, tweets and emails that are circulating, what would the reaction be if the Russians were putting troops ashore in Ireland or Scotland or Canada? Well, how would America react if there were Russian troops put into Mexico? There's no comparison between the severity of the actions by the US and NATO in Eastern Europe with the fact that you have a US that sits largely isolated. Mm. So no, it's no wonder the Russians are beginning to react.
Okay, Alex, so what is the US game plan for the service branches?
But what I'm trying to highlight is that there seems to be a shuffling round of the function of all the US service branches. So at the top there, left there, we have Defense News reporting on Thomas Goffers, who is at the Pentagon's top man for Europe and NATO, the DAS for that part of the world. And the piece is entitled NATO Needs the EU to Move Chess Pieces. And that's what Goffers calls the strategic kit moving under military Schengen now. They're chess pieces. NATO needs EU to move them across Europe. And Goffers says this mobility gives credibility to a reinforcement, that's Russia frightening strategy, for major combat forces. Two things together, says the top man at the Pentagon for Europe. On the front end is having NATO command and control capability, for which read British and American officers, to move the chess pieces, for which read Eastern European goons, around the board. The second is having chess pieces, that's the goons, that are ready to be moved. So, you know, there's increasing amount of European-produced kits, both tanks and aerial assets now, which are going to be at the command of the Brits and Americans, who themselves, particularly on the continent, have got very little to go on now. So on the bottom left, I've just highlighted two interesting things about the lesser known service branches. The US Marine Corps, their in-house paper, as it were, well, it's not quite in-house, but the Marine Corps Times, which, as David and I have been pointing out, keeps calling the Third World War a looming fight, which is understatement of the century, is now talking about Russia's finding of a casus belli in this part of the world. That in the article there, it calls it Russia just can't let it go, that this is happening in Estonia, as if Russia was, you know, a bear with a sore head. And at the same time, the National Guard, which according to some reckonings is a separate branch of the US military, Massachusetts, a liberal state, the governor has said he won't even send the National Guard to the US Texas-Mexico border because of his disagreement with President Trump's policies on migrant control, while in Colorado, a big US Air Force state, the governor is actually sending the Air National Guard, that's the reserve airmen basically, to deploy to Russia's border. And to top it all, President Trump surprises everyone by talking about a space force separate and hived off from the US Air Force. Now, if I put all this together, what I think I've come up with is almost a kind of moving around the circle, and I tweeted about this as well. It seems that the US Army and US Navy have realized they've fallen so far behind in manning that they are going to have to give the more specialist parts of the military. This is a very broad way of speaking. The US Air Force with its very high value airframes, and the US Marine Corps with its total integrated concept and better fighting skills, although they were always at the end of the line for kit. The Marine Corps and the Air Force seem to be the ones who have got some fighting chance in the American planning now of going head to head with the Russians in a Third World War or a local skirmish scenario. The Army and the Navy are basically being hollowed out, turned into shells, and increasingly, when they wish to operate, for example, storming Chinese beaches or Spratly Island beaches, the concept seems to be that they'll use the British and French planning control and other nations like Australia to use to launch the Marines. So US Navy and Air Force do seem to be coming to an end, and well, in their current format. Brian and I have been discussing the next slide on this regard. Perhaps Brian can talk to this one, actually.
This is all about the fallout, really, from the American ship collisions with the Pacific Fleet. And we've had some extraordinary scenes, in some ways very poignant, where parents of servicemen and women who died in the accident have actually kissed. In fact, it wasn't the commanding officer, I don't think, but it was one of the deck officers who was partly responsible for the collision in the Fitzgerald case. She was kissed by one of the relatives who said, well, it's not just your fault. It's a fault with the whole of the Navy's training process. And this is certainly what I'm picking up from all the reports, that we've had some seven serious collisions in the American US fleet. And this has all come about due to a whole combination of things: insufficient manning, overtired ship's company, the crew, overtired, utter confusion and mayhem with the McCain incident. They seem to have completely lost control of the ship itself. And the captain was on the bridge the whole time as it drove into a cargo ship. So this is incompetence, chaos and mayhem, which I've never heard about in the American Armed Forces. And I've got to come back to the work of the retired US Navy Lieutenant Commander Gerald Atkinson, who was warning about what he called the new liberal agenda, which he said was beginning to destroy professionalism and expertise inside the American military. If he's right, and I believe that man is right in his analysis, what we're now witnessing is the result of change agents and disruptors working to hollow out, as you say, the US Navy and elements of the Army itself. So this is an agenda which has been planned from somewhere.
Sorry, Alex. Yes, go ahead.
A very quick codicil to that. I misreported the JG who was being kissed in that article as the commanding officer. He was only, in fact, the officer of the watch, but the officer commanding the Fitz that night was Commander Bryce Benson, sorry, and Admiral James Caldwell, who was appointed to this ship collision oversight view role last year, has now decided that Benson is not going to be court-martialed or even be given negligent homicide charges. He's only going to be given negligent dereliction of duty charges. So that's, of course, a step lower. And he's agreed with his lawyers that he doesn't want a review of the evidence before he goes to the military equivalent of a trial, which seems to me that there's been a stitch-up, a plea bargain. Mm.
It's fascinating. I know we're short for time, but I'll just add into this. That particular commanding officer was lucky to escape with his life, because when the collision had occurred and members of the ship's company forced their way into his quarters, he was actually hanging on to the outside of the ship. So he was very, very lucky not to have been killed. Now, even captains of ships have to sleep at some time, but of course all of the rules say that they're to be called by the deck officer, by the combat officers for particular events. Now maybe there'd been a breakdown of that process, in which case the commanding officer would still be culpable, but I can personally understand why, if he was asleep at the time, then you simply can't say you held total responsibility. Whereas in the McCain incident, the captain, I believe I'm correct in saying this, was on the bridge the whole time, and utter chaos ensued. But it's not one case, it's not two cases. We're up to seven collisions in the Pacific Fleet. And this, to me, says there's a major breakdown in professional performance. Mm.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to this, because just before Christmas, Britain signed a security treaty with Poland, a defence agreement. And that has, well, there's been further announcements about this, because both Boris Johnson and Gavin Williamson today have decided to strengthen security, defence and cyber ties with Poland. This, again, has not been debated in Parliament. There's been no vote about it, but they're going ahead and doing it anyway. So they are in Warsaw today to improve these ties. They're going to look ahead to the upcoming Western Balkan summit in London in the middle of July. In fact, just before the NATO summit, that's going to take place. And then 2019, there's going to be a follow-up hosted in Poland. But anyway, what are they going to be looking at? Well, here's the list of measures. First of all, they're going to strengthen collective defence against cyber attacks and other threats from hostile actors, in sending a clear message that, that such attacks will not be tolerated. This one, I have to say, really grabbed my attention, because they're going to establish a strategic communications project to support independent media in countries in Eastern Europe to ensure a wider range of voices in the media in order to strengthen resilience against disinformation. They're going to jointly work on improving resilience to chemical, biological, radiological and nuclear-related risks. And they're going to further work to prepare for the signature of the UK-Poland Defence Action Plan, which will implement cooperation in a range of military areas. But Alex, it was the second one there, establishing a strategic communications project to support independent media in order to deal with the problems of potential disinformation. I'm not quite sure how this falls under the remit of a defence agreement, but perhaps you can explain that one to me.
Well, defence agreements are, of course, subordinate to the framework of international treaties, the capstone of which is the Peace of Westphalia. And that is one of many treaties which have said that their countries are not going to interfere in each other's internal affairs. Subversion is clearly a way of doing that. So we've been guilty of that through the Cold War, with Voice of America and BBC being effectively arms of the state doing that. But you know, this is a step further in that regard. I think by independent media, they're actually reclaiming that term from us, to claim that independent media will be basically NGO, or these days you could say GO, government organization media, which is off the balance sheets of government, which is actually funded and controlled by government.
Yes, I believe that's exactly the case. But now, what's going on with the Franco-German axis? Interesting choice of term there, Alex.
Yes, of course, it is the motor of the European Empire, and the City of London has always accepted and acknowledged that. But just at the time when we get France and Germany, you can see their nice kit there, in the air and on the ground, deciding to integrate their heaviest hitting units. And at the same time as the French and German finance ministers have said that they're going to harmonise corporation tax, to the horror of the Irish, of course, a way of undermining competitiveness in the peripheral states of the EU. So at the same time, Gates of Vienna has this article, a translation of a piece by Egri Nurk, called Merkel versus Seehofer, Who Will Win? Because the Bavarians, one of the 16 states in Germany, have their own version of the Christian Democrats, and it is a separate party. And for the first time since 1974, they are about to leave the Grand Coalition. And Horst Seehofer, who's the top man in the Bavarian Christian Democrats, the CSU, has been interior minister, but he could not stand what was happening to Bavaria anymore and sealed the borders against Merkel's explicit instructions. People could go back and read the bits I've put on screen there. There's some eye-watering quotes about how the Bavarians are storming out of meetings, saying, "We cannot work with this Merkel anymore. What is she on? She's an enemy of the German people." So, you know, it looks like just at the point where we were told Franco-German integration was going to lead to a European super state, federal state, and still the European parliamentarians are banging their fists on the table and saying this can't come soon enough, like Guy Verhofstadt, the actual political government within Germany is falling apart.
OK, and just very briefly then, F-35 project renders Dutch unable to build aircraft.
I found this particularly laughable and sad for the Royal Netherlands Air Force. Of course, they're used to buying American kit now for recent decades. But of course, in the likes of Fokker, they, in the First World War, particularly sold their technology to both sides. They were at the cutting edge of fighter plane technology in its first generation. And they've got great engineering skill. And now they're having to buy these dodgy F-35s that we report on almost every day. And more than that, they're having to tack their assembly order onto the back of the Italian order book and say, "Would you mind awfully assembling some more and sending them up our way?" Completely shorn of the ability to produce their own fighter planes.
Mm. Okay, well, let's come on to the UK defence industry, because we've got more information coming in on Rolls-Royce, and none of it is good. Basically, we now understand that the management consultancy Deloitte has been brought into Rolls-Royce. What we're being told is that things are becoming absolutely chaotic inside the company. Let's have a look at some of the things that they're saying. Rolls-Royce is being broken up from the inside. Nothing works anymore. The Deloitte teams are confusing the management structure. And when they're told so, they simply ignore the evidence. And what people have really said to us, if they analyse what Deloitte is doing, for them, if you apply common sense, the Deloitte teams are breaking up the management capability of the company. Key engineering expertise is being destroyed. And this is an engineering company, so this is really ripping the heart out of it. Top managers are convinced China will buy them out, or buy the remnants out, and that they consider the Rolls-Royce mini reactor expertise as the real Chinese goal. We'll do a little bit more on that in a second. Key Rolls-Royce intellectual property is simply being given away to the US company Pratt & Whitney. The link of that Pratt & Whitney one, of course, is the F-35. An informed observer says the model for the destruction of Rolls-Royce is a repeat of the destruction of British Leyland and effectively the UK's car industry, where, first of all of the key know-how was simply given away to the likes of Honda and BMW. So very serious stuff. If you go to the Deloitte's website, you can see them boasting about one contract they had with Rolls-Royce working on with a 50,000 strong workforce and employees moving across international borders on a daily basis, how does Rolls-Royce ensure compliance with immigration regulation on a global scale? Fascinating one, that. And this we've shown before, but this is the Rolls-Royce page. And we've brought in the Red Dragon because it's this reactor technology that they're after. This is expertise in Rolls-Royce. And what are we being told? The Chinese want that small modular reactor data.
Quick advertisement for this evening's live programmes, because Ian Crane is in the studio tonight. Crane Report at 7:30, as usual, Fracking Nightmare at 9 p.m. The Crane Report will be talking 5G once again. Now, Ian asked me to alert everybody to a crowdfunder that he has running at the moment. If you have a look on GoFundMe, the title is Fracking Injunction Legal Challenge. This is the Quadrilla attempt to put people in protest pens, prevent any kind of proper protest at future frack sites. And Ian is challenging this with others. So if you can help financially with that, please get onto that GoFundMe page. There'll be more on that on Fracking Nightmare this evening. A reminder that Reverend Andrew Ashdown speaking in Froome at the Rye Bakery on Friday, tomorrow night. Do get along to that if you possibly can. And finally, a reminder that AV9 DVDs are still available on the UK Column website. Now, Alex, we're rapidly running out of time, but let's just have a quick run through a quick update on the Hofschuer case then.
A local magazine in Vienna called Augustin has featured Markus Drexler, who is one of the chaps who has really helped Peter Hofschuer a lot in Austria. He himself has been through the mill. People can freeze the frame to see what he said there. But basically, he was 6 years inside in one of these awful psychiatric gulags in Austria. He protests his innocence, and he says that if you just go by the book and say answer yes to all the straightforward questions like, are you happy here, have you got any complaints, then they'll just keep you in indefinitely. Here is a supporter of ours talking about Peter and his mother Barbara, who's in captivity in York Social Services at Haxby Hall. And she says that they've only recently been given telephone contact with each other, only pre-authorised calls by a family member of the Hofschuers who's on the wrong side are getting through. And, of course, the filtering of calls is in breach of common law and the European Human Rights Act. So whichever model of law you believe in, it's unlawful and illegal. An unsigned letter has come. We're going to see it in a moment from Jane Richardson, probably the social worker, so-called, who has been in charge of this case in the past from York. But down the bottom, we see here, due to Barbara's advanced age, we're in desperate need of funding to take legal action in the matter. If people search for the words leechy Hofschreuer, they will find the page, and donations welcome to start arguing this case as we have done for Peter himself. Now, this is the correspondence which has come from the York Social Services. I'll go through it as quickly as possible. This was faxed to Mr. Hofschreuer in his Austrian psychiatric detention. In our previous letter, we advised you your mum was undergoing tests regarding a bowel condition. These tests, look at the illiteracy, by the way, no full stops. These tests were inconclusive and your mum's health currently appears better. Your mum sleeps well and she likes to spend her days in the communal areas of the home. Blah, 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 blah. She's enjoying the weekly telephone contact that she is able, i.e. we are permitting her to have with you. Next slide. It would be helpful if you were able to provide us with an emergency contact telephone number. What a load of nonsense, because he's in captivity. Your mum received all the letters that are sent to her and is asked regularly if she'd like to write to you or anyone else from whom she receives correspondence. This is an allusion to UK column repeating Peter's call for people to write to Barbara because she's lonely. She's recently declined this at times as she is now able to have the regular chat with you. As previously stated, your mum lacks the mental capacity to be able to determine who she would like to visit her, and therefore this decision has been made in her best interests, ominously and illiterately, best interests are capitalised. However, as part of this process, Mrs. Hofschreuer was consulted, but stated that she did not wish to receive visits from people who she does not know, if you believe that. Mrs. Hofschreuer is currently happy and content in the care home, which is Haxby Hall, and enjoys positive social relationships, blah, blah, blah. We'll write to you in a month. Peter has responded, pointing out that York Social Services has persistently refused to uphold the law and investigate this abuse, despite criticism from the state to investigation, the local government ombudsman, and calls by Lord McGuinness in Parliament for an investigation into your criminal activities. People can freeze the frame and look at the right-hand side, which is the summary of the case, and York Social Services role in captivating Grandma B, Barbara Hofschreuer. And on the next slide, Peter writes, in my conversations with my mother, she constantly complains about being shut in her room all day, so that's a direct contradiction of what's in the letter, denied visitors, having her post withheld and being denied assistance in writing to her friends. This can, of course, conflict with the false information you give me in your letter and explains why you insist on anonymity. The ability to be a pathological liar is high up on the list of requirements needed to become a, quote, social, unquote, worker. My mother's made it very clear she would welcome visitors. Your continual objections to this indicate that you have something to hide. To sum up, York so-called social services has willfully failed in its duty of care to safeguard my mother, has participated in the physical and emotional abuse of her, and has allowed a known criminal to fleece her of her assets. Proud of that, are you, Jane Richardson? This case is now being covered in detail on the UK Column News Service and is now featured in the Austrian press. How long do you and your accomplices think they can get away with anonymity? Yours sincerely, Peter Hofschreuer. One closing comment on this is that the Foreign Office seems finally to be pulling its finger out, although there's been some spanners in the works, and they are equally shocked, at least some of them are, about what's been going on, and they seem to have had information withheld from them.
What can we say? Passionate letter there from Peter Hofschreuer, and quite rightly so, because his elderly mother is basically held in prison. And while saying that, we know there's still a lot of good work being done by people in social services, but we also know that there are many cases where elderly and vulnerable people are being abused in what's become an extremely draconian system. So if people can help, if you can write letters, if you can alert other people to what's happening, that would be great. And at the end of the day, if we don't squash this, any one of us could be subjected to this type of behaviour effectively by the British government, particularly if you dare challenge what's happening with the government policy. We're ending there, yeah. I think. OK, Alex, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you again to the people who alerted us to those key stories today about Common Purpose. Somebody in the chat box said, can't quite understand why they'd be sort of undermining the American military if at the same time they're building up the case for a war? I think our answer to that is what we're really starting to see is the privatization of the military. And also, of course, they are desperate to get their drone technology working at full capacity and super soldiers. We don't actually need human beings anymore. So it does make sense if you look at it on a very big scale. We'll leave it there. Back at the same time tomorrow. We'll also tomorrow include a report on Melanie Shaw. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye.